Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for February's Nurses Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, RCVS Recognised Specialist in Emergency and Critical Care Medicine, Lindsay Kellett-Gregory. Thank you, Lindsay. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Well, thank you and welcome everyone to this webinar where we're going to be talking today about specific nursing considerations for the critical patient in the hospital setting. And it seems reasonable at this point to just start by defining what we actually mean when we refer to the critical patient. And essentially, to put it very simply, we're talking about a sick-looking one when we look around the clinic, although that's not a very advanced description, obviously. But to be more specific, we mean it's really a small population of patients, but they're the ones who are likely to have a highly dynamic condition. So they're the ones that can really rapidly have changes in their condition. And sadly, it's usually a deterioration rather than improvement. They can be unstable. They can need immediate interventions. And unfortunately, they're the ones that may not survive to hospital discharge. And so why are we talking about them today? Well, they can be quite an intimidating patient population to manage and to nurse, and also can be quite difficult to manage in terms of the number of needs that they have and how we go about meeting them. And so because of these things, they really need pretty continual assessment as to what their needs and priorities are at any given time, given how quickly things can change. And we also need to be able to formulate a nursing plan and then deliver that quickly to give them the best chance of survival. And so this webinar, the aim of what we're going to be talking about today is to cover several important aspects of their nursing care based around something called Kirby's Rule of 20 that we'll introduce very shortly. And we'll also talk about the implications of recumbency on nursing management and thinking specifically about hygiene considerations and management of some of their indwelling devices. So that's hopefully what we'll go through today. And so when we sort of consider what the average critical care patient needs, if we think about one that we've sort of managed and had in our clinics up until this point, they can be patients where it can actually be quite daunting to know where do we actually start. It seems like they have so many problems, where do we start with them? Or on the other hand, they might have so many things going on, it could be easy to forget something that they need that ultimately could turn out to be pretty important. And so to try and address this potential difficulty, there's this thing has been introduced and it's called the Rule of 20. And it was made up by a veterinary critical care specialist in the States called Rebecca Kirby. It's known in other sort of textbooks and things as Kirby's Rule of 20. And it's basically a checklist of 20 critical parameters that she recommends are evaluated at least daily in these critically ill animals. And so the way that we can actually use this practically in these patients, we'll go over them today. But in terms of practical application to patients, we can maybe produce a copy like this and paste it into the patient record to act as a prompt for everybody in the team who's dealing with these sick patients to not forget things and act as a memory jog for things that may be relevant to that patient quite uniquely. And there's space on a form like this to add comments as to what's going on, the status of that particular issue, what's being done about it, what the sort of general trend is. I appreciate this in itself could look quite overwhelming. A list of 20 things is not a quick thing to look through and enact. And it's safe to say that not every patient will have needs for all of these categories. But certainly some of them may have a few of them that we need to address and maybe some that are more urgent than others, but it just acts as a bit of a template for us to think about and potentially also act as a template for handover between shift changes as to kind of major issues and how various things are trending over time. And to look at the specific things that are included, this is the checklist that's sort of reproduced in bigger writing, hopefully easier to read. For me, it actually shows just how many things can be deranged in the average critical patient. And we'll go over several of these over the course of this webinar. But we can see if we can target the vast majority of these in these patients, then hopefully we're doing everything we can to improve their outcome, to get them out of the hospital in a good way. To start off, probably one of the biggest things that has an impact on patient outcome is fluid balance, sort of one of the top things on her list of 20. And we know that in the body we've got lots of fluids that are relevant. So we know we've got the circulating intravascular volume that's absolutely vital to deliver oxygen to the tissues and make sure that the patient stays well and organs function well. But we also know that there's fluid elsewhere. There's fluid in cells. There's fluid around cells. And effectively, we have inappropriate replacement and/or maintenance of those different fluid compartments. Then patients really have a poor tolerance of that, and that may be to the point where it's affecting morbidity. So maybe it's affecting organ function, how well they feel, how quickly they recover. But ultimately, it could actually affect their outcome, and deficits in intravascular volume and in getting oxygen to tissues can actually be life-threatening and could mean we lose this patient. So it's pretty important that we have a handle on how the patient's fluid balance is going. And over the next few slides, we'll be talking about how we distinguish between these states of dehydration that I'm sure we'll have all seen. We've got our nice cat here showing the increased skin tent time immediately after we've tested it. And on the right over here, we've got our patient who's coming collapsed, not able to walk systemically and well in a state of hypoperfusion. And we'll talk about these things a little bit more in the next couple of slides. Starting off with hypoperfusion, another term that is used interchangeably for this is the state of shock. And essentially, it's a condition whereby this is the life-threatening form of not having good fluid balance, where we're not getting oxygen to tissues, as we said, and it really is a fast route to losing that patient. And in terms of causes, we've probably seen patients with these sorts of things before, so we can have bleeding as a cause of loss of that circulating volume we talked about. Whether that be external, not quite so much the medical mystery if there's a big bleeding wound, but could well be internal. And certainly the use of emergency ultrasound is emerging at the present time to help look for cavity bleeds, say in the abdominal cavity, the pleural cavity, in a lot of these patients in the hospital. So it's getting easier now to detect hemorrhage in these sort of critical patients as a cause of their failure to do well. But we can also have hypoperfusion or shock because we've lost other fluids from the body, from the gastrointestinal tract, or if a patient is producing vast amounts of urine in excess of the fluid that we're able to put in, or they're sequestering fluid in places that they shouldn't in bodily compartments also. So having a handle on where our patient's at with these sort of fluid losses can be really useful. But ultimately, we want to recognize this quickly. We said this was a potentially a life-threatening situation, and we do that by recognizing changes in these so-called perfusion parameters, as we've got coming up on the next slide. And if we recognize those quickly, it means that we can fix that quickly with fluid therapy, the details of which are a little bit outside the scope of this webinar, but if we spotted it, then we're definitely one step closer to fixing that. And this is a table of these perfusion parameters that we just mentioned. So we can see the column on the left of the slide has really important things that we're going to be assessing in these critical patients to look at fluid balance. So heart rate, mucous membranes, how the pulses feel, those sorts of things. And this table is basically a representation of what would happen to the average dog with hypovolemic shock. So this is where we've lost this circulating volume for the reasons we just talked about, who's read the textbook. So granted, not all of them do that, but hopefully some at least do. And it shows that what happens with these patients is they have a fairly predictable demise in all of these perfusion parameters, ranging from quite mild signs on the sort of the column, the column right here, through to sort of more moderate and more concerning signs, and then finally the severe, but it's also termed late shock, kind of sort of the most severe manifestation over there. The nice thing about this table as well is, as well as helping us detect shock and say how bad it is in these sort of critically ill patients, the really nice thing about it is when we treat them with fluid therapy, they return back in the opposite direction in a very predictable fashion as well. So as we're monitoring these patients in our clinics, any failure to stick with a plan or any deviation from what they're supposed to do can be a really useful prompt for the team to assess that patient and see if something else is going on that we might have missed. Again, I didn't want to talk too much about shock in this webinar because there's so many other aspects to nursing these patients for us to focus on. But just a very brief mention for cats here, to say that these figures relate specifically to dogs in shock. Whereas cats in shock tend to do their own little thing, and typically what their perfusion parameters do as they develop shock is they tend to become bradycardic, and they just tend to progress quite quickly, so it's rare to kind of see early or compensatory shock. We tend to see it when it's quite bad, where they're bradycardic, but they have pale mucous membranes, slow capillary refill time, poor pulses, etc. So cats, that little bit different, but the data here relates to the dogs, as we said. Moving away from hypoperfusion and shock to more dehydration, this is the other thing that we needed to be able to differentiate in these patients or have a handle on their hydration status. And if we think about where fluid is in the body, this is the deficit in the interstitial fluid is what we're actually talking about in this particular instance. And again, we'll have all seen a dehydrated cat or dog, so the ones with the skin tenting, they've got dry mucous membranes, we might be able to appreciate sunken eyes. And if we've run blood work, they might have an increase in their pack cell volume or total solids as everything's just drying, getting a little bit more hemoconcentrated. So usually we're looking at these parameters to assess hydration status. And we know that if a patient becomes dehydrated, then they will tend to lose body weight. And as we rehydrate them, that body weight will go back up again. And so one very easy thing that we can do to assess a patient's hydration status and fluid balance is regular body weight checks. If we have a baseline on them before they became ill, that's great. If not, we can still monitor trends in the hospital. And as such, any day-to-day changes in body weight are more likely to reflect changes in fluid balance rather than changes in adipose tissue or changes in protein banks as well. So it can be a really useful, practical way of assessing these patients' fluid status. We've been talking so far really about deficits in fluids, but we know as well these critically ill patients can be at risk of being overhydrated, having too much fluid, especially if they're receiving intravenous fluids as part of our therapy, and if they're just not handling those fluids well for any particular reason. And those patients, we might spot this because they have progressive increases in body weight above and beyond what we would expect for their normal body weight. This is sort of too much weight gain, if you like, for the amount of fluids that they've been receiving. And the way we pick up on this is it may be a little bit hard to kind of see in this picture, but some of these patients will have a jelly-like consistency to their subcutaneous tissues. They just feel a little bit spongy, for want of a better word. We might see evidence of excess fluid as in serous nasal discharge. We may see peripheral edema, which in some of these patients, especially in dogs, can be hard to detect. But one solid place to look is usually over the tarsus where the Achilles tendon comes in. Usually that's an area of tissue that doesn't have a whole lot of fat there in the average patient. And so if we're seeing edema formation, it can be quite a useful site to look there as an early warning sign. But we may also see chemosis in the eyes and various other things. And by themselves, these don't really sound like that big a deal, but it can become quite severe, as we'll come on to talk about. So if we do see any of these early warning signs, that can be really useful for us to say, let's stop and sort of evaluate where this patient's at in terms of its fluid balance. And this is where changes in hydration status go bad. So usually a little bit of dehydration isn't that big a deal. We've probably all been there in terms of a busy day in the hospital. But if you become severely dehydrated, then that can lead to hypoperfusion, as we talked about, which clearly isn't somewhere that we want our patients to be heading. And on the opposite side, if we have an excess of fluid, then we know that, yes, we can form peripheral edema and nasal discharge, as we just talked about, but one of the most susceptible organs that doesn't handle that so well is the respiratory system and cardiovascular systems. And an unfortunate consequence of that is patients can develop congestive heart failure, which leads to respiratory signs, pulmonary edema, as we can see on the radiograph here. We've got lots of patchy alveolar infiltrates all over this lung field here. Some patients may develop pleural effusion, and both of things can combine to give us changes in our breathing. And so signs that this could be happening, again, we want to look for those early signs in these critically ill patients, any changes in respiratory status, so changes in respiratory rate, effort, what we're hearing on auscultation as we're checking them, and that should all be done very frequently in any patient receiving intravenous fluids, whether or not it's a high rate or not. And monitoring for any changes in cardiac auscultation, so the presence of a gallop rhythm or a change in the intensity of any cardiac murmurs that are present, can all be really useful signs to say things aren't heading in the right direction. We need to sort of assess where a patient's fluid balance may be as well. Ultimately, for these hospitalized inpatients, a good way of monitoring fluid balance overall is to do what we call to monitor ins and outs, which is pretty much what it says on the tin. So what we're doing here is we're having the average patient that we're monitoring fluid balance carefully in, and we're making a record periodically. We typically do this every few hours of all of the fluids going into them. So fluids of any origin, if that be specifically fluid therapy, any drug infusions that they're receiving as well, if that's maybe continuous rate infusions of metoclopramide or similar, or one-off doses of drugs, say omeprazole is one of the ones that we associate with being quite a high fluid volume with the formulation we're using currently. But any fluid going in, any drugs, any fluids, etc., we give a total volume that that patient's been receiving over that period of time that we're measuring it this in. And at the same time, we monitor their outs. So if, depending on how instrumented these patients are, if they have urinary catheters or abdominal drains, say if they're post-abdominal surgery, then we may have ways of specifically measuring that. So urine output, drain output. And in patients with really, really severe diarrhea, so maybe the most severe hemorrhagic gastroenteritis patients, for example, it is possible to have fecal Foley catheters in that collects that liquid fecal material directly into a bag, which is a fantastic aid to nursing, but also great from a monitoring fluid balance standpoint. And we can calculate our outs, and basically over the period of time we're looking at, we can just see, do the two match? And if so, if not, which direction are we going in? Are we losing fluid? Are we gaining fluid? And we can adjust that accordingly. So a really good way of sort of doing things to monitor the fluid balance of these hospitalized patients as well. On a related theme and sort of next on the rule of 20 list is what's termed oncotic pull, or in real terms can be the blood albumin level. So of course, one of the most prolific useful proteins in the blood. And albumin is important for maintaining our intravascular volume. It's a big protein. It helps fluids stay in the intravascular space. And we know that if that protein levels become severely low, then these patients can become edematous. They can third space fluid into body cavities, so they can develop pleural effusion, as we can see on the radiograph here. They can develop quite severe ascites, as we can see on this poor dog at the top of the slide. And as a consequence of that, if they're constantly losing fluid into places that they shouldn't be, they can have quite marked cardiovascular instability. So if we're monitoring these sick patients for their albumin levels, having that number from blood work is definitely useful, but it's more the impact that that number's having on the patients that's relevant. So looking to see how cardiovascular stable they are, seeing if they're having extra third spacing of fluids, and ultimately it's a case of recognizing that's becoming a problem and treating the underlying cause rather than just looking at the number by itself. Blood glucose is something that's typically included on blood work run in the clinic as well, but a particular note in these critically ill patients, it can be quite markedly deranged in some of them. And so starting off with if blood glucose is too high, if they're hyperglycemic, that could be a representation of an underlying disease, so for example diabetes mellitus, but it could also be related to what's going on with them. So we know that patients with severe brain injury, maybe after a hit by car or something, that can cause a transiently but severely elevated blood glucose. And if we have a patient with marked instability, for example, the really severe shock, if we think back to our table of where we talked about the perfusion parameters, these are the patients pushing the far right of that with extremely high heart rates, grey mucous membranes. Just being so systemically unstable can cause transient hyperglycemia as well. So the presence of this in a critically ill patient has to be looked at pretty seriously. If we know that they're not diabetic, they're not more stressed than usual, and they haven't had a brain injury, that for me is a big red flag to say that they're potentially heading towards a so-called stress of dying state, that this is something we need to address pretty quickly, assuming that that's indeed not an artifact and it's a real finding. On the converse, hypoglycemia can be just as bad as well. So it's something we should be suspecting or be on the lookout for, patients becoming hypoglycemic, having a low blood glucose, for any of the things I've listed on the bullet points here. So any cardiovascular instability, any depression in their mental status, they're just not as responsive as before, they're duller. And any patient specifically with a known risk factor for why they might become hypoglycemic. So our lovely cute puppies and kittens, certainly at risk of becoming hypoglycemic, even with relatively minor underlying diseases. But if there's any suspected infection, if there's suspected liver disease, if they're receiving insulin therapeutically, or maybe we've given it as part of the emergency management of, say, hyperkalemia, for example, then those are all patients that we would be thinking about monitoring the glucose quite carefully whilst they're in the hospital to make sure that there's no problems with it. And the reason it's a problem, we've probably all seen these patients before, the sort of hypoglycemic kitten that's come in, can cause really profound cardiovascular instability, and given how reliant the brain is on a constant supply of oxygen for normal function, really quite marked neurologic signs. And treatment of choice obviously being supplementation with dextrose to try and get that glucose level back to a level where the tissues are happy again, and of course investigating the cause for it being low in the first place. We've kind of said that we think about young animals, and we also think about toy breeds of dog, the chihuahuas and so on, at being sort of at risk of hypoglycemia, but realistically it could be any patient in the hospital. It's not limited by body condition score, and certainly both of these dogs here could become hypoglycemic depending on what's going on with them. So it really is anybody could be affected as well. Continuing on the theme of blood work abnormalities that we may see in these critical patients, it's can be reasonably commonplace that we see electrolyte abnormalities, and I've listed some of the more common ones that we see, but not all of them do occur in every patient, thankfully. But it is something that we need to be on the lookout for and assess, usually with daily blood work if these patients are genuinely this sick, but especially in patients receiving fluid therapy, to make sure that we're not missing any abnormalities. And of all of the electrolytes listed here, probably the most common one by far that can become deranged is potassium. And alterations in potassium levels are pretty much to be expected in a critically ill animal. I'm often surprised if the potassium's normal. And it's those derangements are especially common in cats. And in terms of why it's so common, there's lots of reasons why a patient can have a low blood potassium and become hypokalemic, as listed on the left-hand side of the slide here. So they're not eating, they're receiving fluid therapy that probably doesn't have as much potassium in that fluid as their normal blood would, and it's actually helping flush extra potassium out through the kidneys somewhat unhelpfully. They're potentially losing it into their maybe if they have vomiting and diarrhea, and certainly chronic kidney disease in cats is one of sort of the biggest reasons we see for patients having hypokalemia. And initially, the clinical signs of it, it's pretty asymptomatic, so we may not pick up on anything, but as that becomes more severe, then these patients can actually become unwell from the presence of hypokalemia, and so another reason to monitor it to make sure that it's not contributing to the patient's morbidity and why they're not improving. And certainly an appetence weakness progressing through to cardiorespiratory changes can be seen as the degree of potassium becomes even lower. And so the way that we address that is to be pretty proactive and to really look at the potassium before it becomes a problem, so we can look for trends and really stop them getting to the point where we might see some of these more severe clinical signs. And we've probably seen these potassium supplementation charts. It often comes in lots of different formulations and tables in various textbooks and so on. But the basic principle behind it is that we'll look at what the patient's actual blood potassium level is, as noted on the first column of this slide. So we'll see what the blood potassium is and categorize a patient as being on a particular line. And then we can go ahead and say, based on that level of potassium, this is how much potassium chloride typically that we'll add per litre of fluids, and then decide on what fluid rate. And the final of this particular variation of the chart shows the maximum safe administration rate, given that we don't want to give too much potassium. So this certainly isn't to say that this is the fluid rate that has to run at to treat the potassium. This is to say this is the most that you can give safely. So certainly if your patient has, let's say, a moderately low potassium, so 2.6 to 3, then if we wanted to, needed to, we could run that at a rate of 12 mils per kilo per hour, but typically that's obviously a quite high fluid rate, so most of the patients wouldn't necessarily need that. And as we said here, this is something that, depending on how low it is, will depend on how often we monitor that potassium, and we'll can adjust where we are on this chart based on the patient's response. On the counter, hyperkalemia or hypotassium, again, several reasons why a patient might become hyperkalemic. And whilst there's lots of differentials, so as a sort of I've listed several on the slide here, probably one of the biggest reasons for a critically ill patient in the hospital that we've already started getting a handle on their underlying disease to become hyperkalemic is acute kidney injury. So by that we mean that the kidneys have just stopped working to a greater or lesser extent based on something else that's going on in the body, if not being the initial cause of them presenting. And so it's something that we really need to be on the lookout for and hopefully find it before it finds us. And the reason behind this is that hyperkalemia can be a cause of really severely marked cardiovascular instability. If we think about the sickest cat we've ever seen with urethral obstruction, then that's basically what these cats are presenting with. And we know that it can cause a series of cardiovascular effects, as we've seen here. A bunch of arrhythmias are sort of this figure spells out quite nicely how that can progress over time. And unfortunately, it can proceed to cardiac arrest. And so monitoring patients to see what their blood potassium is doing is really helpful to try and avoid getting to this point. And of course, ECG monitoring can also be helpful to see where we're at with these patients and make sure that we're not having any of these early cardiovascular effects coming in. Moving away from the cardiovascular system and onto more respiratory system, we talked about how monitoring patients' respiratory status when they're receiving fluid therapy is important, but that really applies to any patient that fits into this critically ill category we're talking about today. Her respiratory rate and effort and pattern are all useful, but ultimately one of the most important things is auscultation, which is something that hopefully people can be doing with their patients several times a day, looking for really small changes. So we're finding subtle, for example, subtly increased lung sounds before we find a bunch of pulmonary crackles and a massive respiratory effort that represents the fact we're well into a problem. We have lots of other data that we can collect as well, so we can actually monitor blood oxygen levels with pulse oximetry, and that could be a useful thing in any patient with suspected respiratory compromise to provide some objective evidence as to how that patient is doing. And some of the common differential diagnoses for respiratory changes in the critical patient that we need to be mindful of, I've listed on the lower end of this slide, and we'll see the first of those, volume overload, relates to the importance of that fluid balance that we talked about already. And this is the same radiograph we saw of the volume overloaded cat that's developed congestive heart failure. But other possibilities, thinking about aspiration pneumonia, progression of what they've already got, other conditions as well need to be thought of too. If one of our inpatients has a chest drain already placed for management of any pleural space disease, then they have specific management demands of their own, and a lot of that is related to avoiding additional complications. So oftentimes it kind of goes without saying, but it is really of paramount importance that these chest drains are handled aseptically. We wear sterile gloves. We're very mindful of handling and trying to prevent contamination of these sites. As such, we're handling it as little as we need to, but we're checking at least the insertion site of those drains daily and doing everything we possibly can to keep this site clean to try and avoid acquiring an infection. And another complication we're keen to avoid as well is any air leakage from the outside world into that pleural space and the development of what's a pneumothorax. And as such, being very careful with how we're sealing off these drains with sealed valves or clamps or three-way taps or whatever we need to do to make sure that this drain is being helpful to us clinically and not introducing extra complications. Typically, when we have a chest drain in, then it's because we've got something that was pre-existing in that pleural space that we wanted to get out. And so we'll typically be aspirating these drains periodically to try and empty out whatever that is, whether it be fluid or air. And things that we'll be wanting to do are to, oftentimes these patients' drains yield more productively if the patient's in one body position versus another. So it's definitely worth trying to do that to try and empty out as much as we need to. At the same time, making a note mentally and in the medical record, of course, about the volume of fluid, the character of that fluid, to build up a picture of how that patient's improving over time, to hopefully provide supportive evidence to say that we're getting on top of the underlying disease, the reason why that chest drain was placed, but also be on the lookout for any of these complications that we just talked about. The neurologic status of a patient is another one of the big things listed on the rule of 20 as well. And one of the quickest ways to kind of assess that in these critically ill patients is by looking at their level of consciousness or their mentation. And again, this is something that we're probably used to doing subconsciously, but it's something that we're being more mindful of if we're sort of engaging with this this list of checkpoints. And trying to categorize a patient as to whether they're obtunded. So I think previously this was referred to as being depressed, but obtunded means that you're responsive, but just not at the level, sort of normal responsiveness that you would expect a normal patient to be. Through to stuporous, where your default is that you're not responsive, but if you are subjected to a noxious stimulus, such as a toe pinch or something, then you are capable of waking up and responding to that. Through to the other end of the spectrum, the most concerning is comatose, where your default is you're non-responsive and there's nothing that we can do that will change that. They're just non-responsive to anything, even those noxious stimuli that we just mentioned. And one of the tricky things about the neurologic status in these patients is that a decline in mentation could be due to a neurologic problem. So maybe this is a patient who's in for seizures and the decline in mentation is related to whatever's causing that seizure disorder. But we also know that we can develop neurologic signs from problems elsewhere in the body. So if a patient comes in, for example, with severe shock, if that brain isn't getting enough oxygen because of a problem elsewhere, then that could be manifest as a neurologic sign. So something that we need to do is to sort of put into context, is the mentation appropriate for the patient with everything else is going on, and try and decide if there is an impairment in their neurologic status, is that likely related to something else? And therefore, do we need to investigate if that's related to their glucose, their cardiovascular stability, and all of the other things we're talking about today? In more practical terms and related to any patient, is any patient with a decrease in level of consciousness, we really need to be checking if there's a gag reflex present. So are they capable of protecting their own airway from any gastric or esophageal contents and therefore any subsequent aspiration pneumonia? And as such, really it should be a natural follow-on that a patient with impaired level of consciousness should have their gag reflex checked. And efforts made to protect them if it does turn out to be absent at any point. The whole neurologic system can be a little bit daunting in itself, and certainly one of the things that can be a good way of monitoring these patients and communicating any sort of changes between colleagues at shift handovers is using scoring systems. So somewhat akin to pain scoring that I'm sure lots of people are using. There's something called the Modified Glasgow Coma Scale, which is basically it's an objective monitoring system of the neurologic system in patients with specific neurologic dysfunction that we're sort of tracking over time. And the benefit of it is instead of, for example, if we're rounding on a patient, we said that Fluffy's a bit brighter today or Fluffy's a bit quieter. Whilst that may be true, it can be hard for somebody new on the case to quantify if we're just coming into a shift and sort of taking over nursing care for a given patient. What the potential advantage of these coma scales are that you have, it's much more objective, you have a number, and that can just provide a bit more detail in that communication as well. And the way it basically works is that you have three separate categories that we look at here. So the first is motor activity, the second is brainstem reflexes, and the third is level of consciousness that we talked about doing already. And what we basically do within each of these categories, so we do this for all three, is we look at the various descriptors present for each, and we allocate each patient a score. So six being the highest achieving patient and one being the lowest achieving patient. So for level of consciousness, six being you're mostly okay, one being you're really not. And you assign a score, and we can see from this that the maximal score you can attain is 18, which says, okay, neurologically, you're in a good spot. The lowest being 3, which is obviously pretty concerning. And so we can track this over time and hopefully use this as a sort of guide to looking at progression in these patients, hopefully in a positive direction, but picking up on subtle changes in the negative direction if they do occur. Blood pressure is something that we also are going to be monitoring in these patients as well, and investigation into any abnormalities of blood pressure is really important as well, because we can have deviations in both directions. So we can have hypotension or a low blood pressure defined as a systolic blood pressure of less than 90, and hypertension, so too high, defined as a blood pressure over 170. And the reason being is that we need enough blood pressure to make sure that we've got adequate tissue perfusion and we're getting the blood to those organs, as we've talked about before, but also making sure we don't have too much pressure that could be injuring other organs in the body. So by injuring the brain and causing neurologic signs, injuring the kidneys and potentially worsening any insults they're already sustained, or providing new problems altogether, such as ocular complications, as we can see the picture on the right showing some retinal hemorrhage, which is sort of extra morbidity we can do without. So checking blood pressure periodically, and certainly more commonly if an abnormality is found or predicted based on what the underlying disease is, so that we can monitor that, make sure the patient doesn't develop any extra problems, and hopefully use this as a marker as to how the patient is doing overall as well. Looking at the cardiovascular system a little bit more, doing a TPR, so a temperature pulse respiration, is probably one of the most common things that we'll do to monitor these patients in practice. But specific to the critically ill patient, we're really looking at trends in those things. And looking at the cardiovascular system, looking at trends in heart rate over time to see if there's a progressive increase that might represent instability, or if there's progressive signs of, say, tachycardia, increases in heart rate before the next dose of analgesia is due. We can really use this sort of data to build up a picture as to how best to manage these patients and intervene as needed. And other things that we can think about are, as we talked about, regular auscultation of the heart to pick up any abnormal sounds that might guide our additional therapy, and looking at sort of ECG and patient-side ultrasound, and looking at these to give us clues specific to our patients if that's of interest for their underlying disease status. The sort of the temperature part of that TPR, it can be a relatively common occurrence for critically ill patients to become hypothermic, especially if they've had anesthesia, they've had surgery, or they're just so systemically unwell they're having a hard time maintaining body temperature. And so that's something that we can keep an eye on and, of course, treat supportively if needed. But what can potentially be a more urgent situation is if they have elevations in their rectal temperature. And the major sort of classification that we put that into is if they're hypothermic or pyrexic. And by hypothermic, this basically means that they have an increased rectal temperature, but it's largely because of environmental factors. So an extreme would be a dog, trapped in a car on a hot day, or a brachycephalic dog who just has trouble thermoregulating, or a stress response or something of that nature. And that could definitely happen in this critical patient population, but the other major rule out that we're thinking for these sort of more sick looking patients is pyrexia, where we have where the sort of body's normal set point for where they think the temperature should be has been elevated because of underlying disease. And that's the sort of the more common one we'll see in these sort of real sickies. To kind of finish up, I mean, hypothermia is something to be mindful of, and certainly one thing that we watch our brachycephalic breeds quite closely for in the hospital is the new onset of hypothermia, to make sure that they don't have any airway crises or temperature crises whilst in the hospital. So recognising that quickly and intervening quickly if need be. But the more common one, as you said, the pyrexia. Really, the temperature itself in these patients isn't necessarily so much the concern, the actual number. The bigger concern is that we've seen a trend towards the temperature being elevated, and now it definitely is. And that the concern is probably relating to the fact there's a reason behind that in these patients. So typically the sort of common ones we'll think about is if there's an aspiration pneumonia, there's been an inhalation of gastric or esophageal contents, and that's set up an infection in the lung. If there's a urinary tract infection, and certainly any patients that have had urinary catheters in place as part of their management at any point whilst hospitalised could be an easy next step. Wound infections for any post-surgical patients, and certainly reviewing any of our intravenous catheters or other indwelling devices, like we talked about chest drains, urinary catheters, abdominal drains, those sorts of things, to see if there's a reason for a patient to be pyrexic. So, and typically in the presence of a pyrexia, we're using it more as a clue to what's caused it. We're not so worried about cooling them or adding in anti-inflammatories, which could potentially mask what the temperature has been doing. We're more saying that this is a really good clue to say there's a complication potentially with these patients that could be causing them not to do well, so we can look at that nice and quickly. Looking to the hemoglobin concentration or the red blood cell count in these patients is also important, because anemia is a really common finding in these critically ill patients. And just listed some of the things here, there's lots of reasons why they're susceptible to becoming anemic. But probably one of the biggest ones is that it's been shown that frequent blood sampling of critical cats and indeed small dogs can be a cause of anemia all by itself, severe enough to actually necessitate blood transfusion within 3 or 4 days of hospitalisation. And so clearly that's something that we need to be looking for as a sort of the care team on these patients. And thinking about using blood tubes, sort of small fill blood tubes, and doing what we can, minimising blood that we take, or number of instances of phlebotomy and wasted blood, to try and reduce that as a risk. And in terms of if a patient does become anemic, it's sort of a webinar itself, if you like. But in terms of when to treat, it's always a discussion between the sort of balance between oxygen delivery that the red blood cells that are present can do and how the body's coping with that. And also bearing in mind the cost of transfusions, the availability of transfusions, it's not necessarily such a straightforward decision. So if there are simple things that we can do to stop it getting worse, then that's going to be really quite helpful to us. Unfortunately, there's also lots of reasons why these critically ill patients can have renal dysfunction, in terms of if they've got shock, cardiovascular instability, they've got dehydration, they've had low blood pressure, they've had low blood oxygen, maybe they've had drugs that are damaging to the kidneys. And that can have impacts on the fluid balance and the potassium, as we've talked about already today. So in terms of monitoring renal function in these hospitalized patients, then getting baseline renal values and urinalysis can be really quite a helpful thing to do if we suspect we've got a sick patient on our hands, so at least we can look for changes over time. But in terms of actual monitoring, then looking at the volume of urine being produced is really useful, and any decreases being a big red flag to say that there's a problem with why the kidneys aren't doing what they're supposed to, as well as sequentially tracking what's happening with their renal values on blood work and looking at blood pressure as a potential consequence, hypertension being a consequence of a declining renal function. So those are all things that we can do to monitor that. Another one of the things that Kirby's rules throw up is thinking about their risk for infection and immune status. And there's lots of things that we'll think about if we bury a nurse a patient in terms of their safety, the safety of our animals, the safety of staff if it's a zoonotic infection that we don't want to come home with anything from a shift that we didn't go in with. And we'll think about individual patients as potentially being more at risk. So we know that the ability of the body to fight infection is assessed through white blood cell counts. So if a patient is known to have a lower white blood cell count, then they're considered more at risk. We'll think about wearing appropriate personal protective equipment and thinking about ways we can protect patients. And so these are all things with any given patient that we need to be mindful of, that they, even if they don't have an infectious disease to start with, that they don't acquire one whilst they're in with us. Critical illness is also often and also associated with what's called ileus. So by that we mean a decrease in motility of their normal gastrointestinal tract and possibly some gastrointestinal ulceration as well. And the reason being, I've just listed a few factors on the left of this slide here why they're predisposed. And we can see that there's lots of reasons why the average critical patient would be at risk. And why is it so bad? Well, the problem with ileus or this decreased motility is that it can cause a host of other problems. So it can cause issues directly related to the gastrointestinal tract and function. So it can cause copious regurgitation, which obviously isn't pleasant for the patient, but ultimately reduces nutritional intake as well from a sort of voluntary intake standpoint. But it can cause really severe and potentially life-threatening complications of pneumonia, of sepsis, and also just poor recovery from whatever they've had. And so to monitor for this, then it's recommended that any patient should be escorted at least 3 times daily for bowel sounds, just over the abdominal area. And a big clue that ileus is present is that these sounds are a decreased in auscultation. We can be suspicious that it is there in those cases. How do we manage ileus if we do suspect or confirm that it's present? Well, some of the things are pretty simple. So encouraging patient movement, if possible and feasible to do so, getting them up and about to help things get moving. Thinking about prokinetic drugs, so drugs that will actually help the intestinal movement therapeutically if appropriate and not contraindicated for any other reason. Minimizing any opioid drugs that are given, so obviously not to the point where we're going to be making these patients be painful, but to the point whereby we're reviewing whether or not a patient's opioid needs are the same today as they were yesterday. Could that dose be reduced, or could the agent be downclassed? So for example, we know that buprenorphine is associated with less ileus than say methadone would be, so thinking about where is a patient at in terms of, is there anything we can refine? And also supporting nutrition, so with voluntary feeding if they'll handle it, or if not, then thinking about, is this a patient that would benefit from some tube feeding to help get some nutrition in, help get that gut function a little bit more. Some patients may well need antiemetics, and certainly in those with protracted vomiting or a predisposition for complications from vomiting, such as a decreased mental status or abnormal gag reflexes, things that we've talked about before, and we'll think about it in those patients. But ultimately, ileus is probably best treated by so-called gastric decompression. And what we mean by this is placing a nasogastric tube and to actually suction and take off any excess fluid or gas that's building up there as a result of this decreased motility. And ultimately that helps to reduce any vomiting or regurgitation and reduce the risk for some of those adverse effects of ileus too. And in terms of the actual practicality of how to do that, these tubes are really very easy to place. There's lots of sort of good resources that will give you a lot of detail as to how to place these. But They're typically small bore tubes that are placed in a conscious patient. They're usually very well tolerated with a previous drop of local anaesthetic just up the nose. And they can allow some extra nutritional support to be delivered if that's what the patient needs, but also gastric decompression simply by aspirating back on these tubes once we've confirmed they're in the right location. On the downside, even though we can provide nutrition this way, then because these tubes are very, very small, we're pretty limited on what our choices are. Some patients just don't tolerate them, and once they're placed, the patients make it their life's work to remove them. In those cases, it's not so helpful to us, but it's very much a short-term in-hospital use only, but maybe worth considering as a sort of adjunctive treatment of ileus for some of these more challenging patients. On the subject of nutrition, if you kind of look in the average sort of food store in terms of options that we have to feed patients while they're in the hospital, there's a whole host of choices. But oftentimes it's not so much the case of what we're feeding, just that we are feeding. And it's pretty rare that prescription diets are truly indicated in the hospital. And actually, it's unlikely they're going to, simply by feeding a specific prescription diet, it's unlikely that that's going to be the one thing that turns around the patient's clinical condition. It's potentially more likely to help introduce a food aversion to that specific food we want them to eat when they're out of the hospital and feeling a whole lot better. But the priority should maybe more how much they're actually eating. So be mindful of what their daily requirements are. This so-called RER, or resting energy requirement, is the sort of daily calories that the given patient would need as calculated by the formula included on this slide. And making sure that we do what we can to hit that. So typically in these patients, we'll start with a third of that recommended energy requirement and then increase that sequentially over days as long as it's tolerated, dividing it into meals. But whereas in the past, in some of the textbooks, we'll talk about illness factors and providing multiples of this resting energy requirement in these sick patients, newer research has shown actually that can be quite detrimental. And so we're simply, instead of worrying about types of diets and illness factors, we're just making it much more simple and saying what is the resting energy requirement and doing what we can to deliver that if at all possible. One of the other things that may well not have been considered before, unless you're thinking about this rule of 20, is thinking about drug dosages and what's actually happening inside the patient after drugs have been delivered. And we said that some of these patients can be predisposed to organ dysfunction. We've talked about kidneys, but also liver is an organ that can be impaired as well in these sick patients. And unfortunately, most drugs, if you look in any sort of formulary, will tell you that they're probably excreted or metabolized by the liver or kidney. And so it may be the case that a patient might need some dosage alterations if those organ systems are dysfunctional. And as a team, that can be a sort of daily discussion as to what the sort of strategy is going to be if we need to do anything special for this patient given their sort of current status. Another impact as well that has direct nursing implications is that it's much more likely if the patient is critically ill that they're on more drugs at any point in time, whether that be drugs to support their gastrointestinal tract, whether that be analgesic agents, whether that be other sort of more life-supporting drugs to sort of keep them cardiovascularly stable. Could be any host of things, but the more drugs that we're giving, the more likely we are to have drug interactions. And so we need to be mindful of that in terms of the actual timing of these drugs, and also to make sure that if drugs are being given in the same infusion lines, that they are indeed compatible. And there are various apps that can be used to sort of track this, but oftentimes this is a case of people cleverer than me setting up the logistics as to how we're actually going to get all of these drugs safely into one given patient. And the final thing to think about is when we're giving these drugs, we talked about how changes in body weight in a critical patient can be reflective of fluid balance. We might need to, when we're thinking about drug dosages, think about what a patient's normal lean body weight should be in dose for that. And that really gets rid of any variation that we might have seen through changes in fluid balance, as we've talked about before. And the final point on this is we'll think about any reviewing current drug dosages specifically in these patients, given that they often have polypharmacy, as we said, and the more drugs you're on, the more likely you are to unfortunately have an error in those calculations that could actually have quite devastating complications. And so thinking about these patients' drugs and double checking any of the ones that you know are potentially more dangerous. So things like insulin obviously being sort of one of the big ones we worry about. But having those be double checked, and especially that being the case if it's a sort of less commonly used drugs that we're sort of reserving for these sicker patients, double checking on what we're doing with those as well. Pain control, we've sort of touched on a little bit already, and we were talked about scoring systems, but pain control is an absolute priority in these critically ill patients. Should be for any patient, but if you have a patient who's this sick, this unwell, then it really comes to sort of the top of the priority list. And we're typically avoiding using any non-steroidal agents, any non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents in these patients for the reason that we said that they're potentially predisposed to gastrointestinal dysfunction and maybe renal dysfunction, and non-steroidals having side effects in both of those organ systems, which basically leaves us with opioids as a sort of first line, and we'll typically use methadone as a sort of licensed product in the UK, as sort of one of our first line agents. But regular pain scoring, super important to sort of check that we're doing the best that we can by these patients, and not being afraid to increase additional drugs. And certainly common things that we'll consider in our canine and feline patients are infusions of, if intermittent methadone, for example, isn't adequate, infusions of fentanyl, adding in infusions of ketamine, lidocaine, if appropriate. And not forgetting our local anaesthetics, are sort of, is there local blocks or anything else that we can do to make these patients more comfortable whilst they're recovering. Moving on to sort of the recumbent patient as we sort of finish up, then probably one of the biggest priorities that we have is maintaining good hygiene. So obviously these recumbent patients have a particularly challenging to manage of their own accord. And sadly can be more at risk of infections. And so whether that be wound infections, skin ulceration, ascending infections from the urinary system, they're really high risk for developing a complication. And so right from the outset, rather than waiting for there to be a problem, instead right from the outset being proactive, trying to offset that with tail wraps, placing urinary catheters to help with urinary system management, those fecal collection systems we talked about before, putting them on incontinence pads to help sort of soak up liquids as opposed to sort of standard bedding. They can all be really important aspects to try and help with the sort of hygiene of these patients as well. In terms of trying to prevent other complications, if a patient is truly recumbent, and that probably means that they're not up and about eating and drinking normally, and so they can need more attention to oral care to prevent any sort of erosions, ulcerations, or sort of building up of secretions in the oral cavity if they're not, certainly if they have depressive mentation, they're not up and about and swallowing frequently. And so regular suctioning, regular rinses with chlorhexidine or similar agents can be really useful just to try and reduce the bacterial load and try and keep the area cleaner and less susceptible to sort of the injuries we can see on this poor creature on the left of the slide. And also bearing in mind that ocular care, especially if they're recumbent and they may be on drugs that may well be impairing their normal tear production or impairing their sort of ability to blink normally, with the ultimate aim to prevent any serious or ocular ulcerations, as you can see in this picture here. So we'll typically provide ocular lubrication very frequently. We'll maybe do it hourly, even in particularly at-risk patients. So we'll all know breeds that we're particularly concerned about, but patients with a history of eye problems, and we'll typically fluorescein the eyes daily as a team, just to make sure that we're not missing something that could develop into something bigger a lot later on. These recumbent patients typically need to be turned at least every 4 hours or maintained sternal if they possibly can, and certainly benefit from physiotherapy to help maintain muscle tone and blood flow to those organs, but also minimize any sort of scald or pressure sores, and minimize any sort of collapsed lung from being in one position for any long period of time. So doing that in conjunction with the pain score and all of the other factors that we've talked about is a really, really important thing to not forget whilst we're sort of doing everything else with these patients as well. And then any, if when the patient's underlying disease has any sort of wounds or if they've had surgery and have any incisions, then we need to check those wounds daily to ensure that they're healing properly. Obviously, any time that there's any sort of moisture on a bandage, and that needs to be changed to make sure there's no strike through, and making sure that any sort of bandages that are present are there for a reason, and that all catheter sites, etc., are checked at least daily for sort of the sites are okay, they're drawing okay, they're flushing okay, and if there's any impaired wound healing, thinking about the possibility of an infection early on. And then the final point of the Kirby's Rule of 20 to mention, and actually my favourite one, is tender loving care. And it's something to say that really the mental health of the patient is often as important as the physical health, which usually takes sort of precedence in terms of like the veterinary care provided. But thinking about things like providing quiet time for rest, especially important if patients are having treatments throughout the day and night, if they're that genuinely sick, then allowing, trying to bunch treatments together so at least they can have some downtime so they're not constantly being messed with, being mindful with our scheduling. Actually having quiet time in the room where the lights are dim to allow some degree of rest so they can actually sort of switch off, and having noises be minimized. And all of the reasons why we should do that, has definitely a lot of evidence out there to say that it helps with patients' mobility, helps with appetite, has other medical benefits. But clearly it's just something that because we should. If we have this this patient population, then it'd be how I'd want my pet to be treated. And Kirby's Rule of 20 really puts that in there as well. So notwithstanding all of the other things that we've talked about doing in these patients, then tender loving care not to be underrated, and actually could be scheduled as a sort of regular event in these patients as well, especially if they have lots of other stuff going on. And so that brings us to the end of the webinar today. Hopefully that answers some of your questions about how we can approach these patients and hopefully help to improve their outcome into the future. Thank you.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Lindsay for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.